Hi, and welcome to this special edition of Appalachian Mysteria. I am not Kendall. I am Maddie Stout, president of Jam Street Media, and we are the folks that help bring you this podcast. We're going to do a couple things during these bonus episodes. I'm going to talk to Kendall and Sarah about the podcast and about themselves and about podcasting in general and how they built these shows. Some other things that we're going to do is get some updates on the cases. We're going to tease what's going to happen in season three, but keep in mind, we're talking about these podcasts as if you've already listened to them. So if you have not listened to them, maybe go listen to them and come back and then check out this bonus material. And I'll tell you this, I just listened back for the second time and I got so much more information that I missed the first time. So if you haven't listened to them twice, please go do that. Before we can do anything else, let me just introduce the folks doing the podcast today and the folks who bring you Appalachian Mysteria, Kendall Perkinson and Sarah James McLaughlin. Hi, how are you?
It's good to talk to you again, Maddie.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you.
Okay, I want to start first with your backgrounds and how you came to become podcasters. You both have different backgrounds, and the story of how you met to do the first podcast, the WVU Co-Ed Murders, is pretty interesting. So whichever one of you want to kind of take the lead on how you got started, and then you guys can kind of come together on how you met.
So I probably didn't listen to a podcast before we actually started making them. I wasn't really familiar with them. Kendall had all the expertise there, but I met Kendall and we were standing on his porch and I was like, hey, do you want to hear about the worst murder that's ever happened in this town where you just bought a house? And he's like, sure. And I had just published an article on Reddit about it and I sent it to him and I was explaining it and there are all these twists and turns. And he's like, do you want to maybe send this to a bigger audience and do a podcast? And I'm like, maybe.
Well, Kendall, what's got you into this world and podcasting? And, you know, you've got a background in doing, you know, some traditional radio. What led you to this medium?
I'm big into DIY. I'm big into community stuff. I lived in Richmond for a while, and there is a all-volunteer radio station in Richmond. It's a great station, 97.3, for anyone who is in Richmond. They probably already know it. But this station, I called it up. It was just getting started. I said, what can I do to help this community media outlet? And they said, well, we need shows. And I was like, I don't make shows. But I had recorded music, sort of, you know, bedroom sort of music recordings, songs that I was writing and that sort of stuff. So I knew how to work microphones. I had the software to record and I was interested in both news and media. So I was like, all right, I'll give this a shot. Did that for a number of years. It involved sort of creating my own political radio show. And I kind of missed it, frankly, since I'd moved away from Richmond years before. And this struck me as a story that could be told, first of all, could be told in long form. It could be told in a series of multiple twists and turns. There were easy, just sort of like cliffhanger stuff, you know, just automatically built into the story. It was something that was tying me to a community here. We got local musicians and all that sort of stuff and met lots of local, you know, news media people and photographers, lawyers, et cetera. So I just enjoy the process of creating media, frankly.
So are you both murder freaks? I mean, is that a, I think people always wonder that when somebody decides, hey, I'm going to spend not just hours, but hundreds of hours creating a podcast about a murder. Are murders something that's on the top of both of your minds normally? Sarah, I'll start with you since you were the one that brought the story to Kendall.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I think about murder 24/7. But I do really enjoy watching documentaries about unsolved things or even serial killers like Dahmer. I mean, it's really fascinating. And I think it's sort of from the perspective of someone who feels vulnerable, like you want to learn as much as you can just so you feel a little bit safer. And so I kind of got into this case because I just had this random thought one day. I was like, you know, I remember my parents telling me about these girls that had their heads cut off. And I wonder if that's real. And I just kind of went off on this segue where I was doing all the research, finding the newspapers, and it was stranger than what they'd even told me about. So I got really obsessed about it, to be honest. I was like looking into it 24/7 and I was like, I don't even know what I was going for. Like, I knew I wasn't going to find out who did it or anything, but I wanted everything that I could have because it just didn't feel right with the court, their verdict. It just never sat right with me.
I never had any real interest in true crime or murders. It's not something that I thought about a lot. I've done some media work on crime and guns and that sort of thing. So it's not that I never think about terrible things that happen, but as far as the true crime, you know, murder story sort of thing, I was never into that. I didn't get into this because of that. And frankly, I didn't really listen to any other true crime podcasts before I made this. I didn't even think of it as a genre. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's not true. Everyone listened to Serial. But I didn't approach it thinking it would be like Serial or anything like that. Really, this is all about the storytelling for me. I'm just super interested in ways you can tell stories in an interesting way. And of course, these are inherently interesting stories because they deal with very strange, often gruesome facts that are sort of shocking to the senses, but also because they're real and because real people, you know, suffered real things in these stories. So there's a gravity to it that I'm drawn to as well.
Once we got started, I didn't even realize how much I would enjoy like the historian aspect of this. Like we're archiving these things that could be gone forever. And that's kind of hooked me into wanting to do more.
Well, I think, you know, we're going to dive into Merritt and Karen and then dive into Big Savage during this interview. But I'm very interested in this the whole art of doing a podcast. As somebody who's been doing them for a while, you know, the kind of podcast that you do is really hard. It's not something that every Joe can grab a microphone, go in their bedroom and make one. There's so much to it. And I think, you know, hearing that you didn't really listen to a lot of podcasts before, both of you, I think that makes sense to me because there are so many nuances to your podcast that make it unique. It's what drew me to it. And one of them is that history aspect. You know, I love the history that you guys really do. And you can tell that you really care and that this is something that the excitement in your voices come out when you're doing your podcast is something that I find just really, really nice.
There have definitely been some manic moments when we find new stuff about the case. And like, I have to go tell someone about it. I'll call Jeff. And if I'm not satisfied with his reaction, then I call Kendall and I'm like, just someone please celebrate this with me.
I'll second Sarah on what she said a little bit ago. There's no doubt in my mind that this case would not be as well documented anywhere else as it is here. As it is with the Merritt and Karen, you know, season one of Appalachian Mysteria. That alone makes it one of the most important, you know, projects that I've ever worked on because it really does preserve a piece of history in a way. You know, you listen to a lot of true crime podcasts and many of them are often reading, you know, Google stuff, you know, stuff that exists, like more compiling of information. But we managed to pull stuff together here that I think people wouldn't have heard otherwise, especially not in a collected sort of volume.
Now, you know, doing these podcasts, you're very honest and you share the ups and the downs. So that includes trying to reach out to people and having them not get back to you or reaching out to somebody and having them talk to you and then stop talking to you. It must be very frustrating. And I have to imagine, you know, I am from West Virginia as well. I know that West Virginians are very friendly, but they're also very private. You know, they don't like talking to strangers. How is that and how frustrating is that when you're making a podcast to try to get people to talk?
One of the things that is really frustrating is I feel like a lot of the people that we talk to, I'm making a connection. I try to build some rapport there and I try to, you know, help them vet me to make sure that they understand that like we have the interest of the story at heart. We're not trying to bias the listener in any way. And so like I work really hard on that. So when we have people that ghost us, it's really hard not to take it personally. And it happens often enough, like you said, because there is a culture here where people really have this opinion that you let sleeping dogs lie. And I don't agree with that in this case, especially with Merritt and Karen. I don't think that not talking about things is going to help them in any way, but talking about things might drum up some leads that it's something might be actually figured out, if not for the benefit of the families, just to kind of know, like, if there was a problem, how can we learn from this? So it's very disappointing when people don't get back to us. Like it's a very time intensive and emotionally intensive process.
I feel like the people who do talk, it's not because they willy-nilly talk to anyone. It's because it's something that's bothered them for years. Or in the case of Big Savage, something that's, you know, still actively bothering them. I think for some people talking about older cases, maybe feels like participating in maybe resolving their feelings about it. And for the people who don't, who just refuse to, I don't know, maybe it's hard for them to face those really, you know, all the difficult emotional stuff that these sorts of stories bring up. I'm not sure.
Do you get scared? You're talking about murders. You're talking about, you know, crime and people associated with crime. And are there times when you've been scared doing this and talking to people?
I can't say that I've ever been intimidated by anyone that I've talked to. I have talked to some people that I was a little bit concerned with. So I did have a state trooper that I knew go and vet them because I just got a weird vibe. And when he talked to them, he came back and he was like, that guy's not who he says he is. But it was never in person, but it was a little bit creepy. That's the only time I can think of that I ever had like a bad feeling that something's not right here.
I don't think it's ever been necessary for me to be afraid. A lot of the communication we do is virtually, is electronic these days, or by phone, by landline, especially for older folks.
One thing that I love about your podcast and what make you, again, I think very unique podcast producers is the music and using local musicians. There is a lot of care that goes into your sound design. And it's one part of a podcast that I think people that listen to a lot of podcasts notice and really can appreciate how much work it is. But for folks that haven't, you know, really delved into it, it might be overlooked. I just want to talk to you, Kendall, about that and your thoughts behind the music that you pick and how you put it into the podcast.
Sarah and her fiance have been around this area a lot longer than I have, and they have connections to a music scene that I didn't have connections to. I'd only been here for 2 or 3 years when we made this show. And so they knew a lot of great bands. They helped a lot in sort of weeding through, you know, all the local musicians and finding the stuff that would really work for the show. A lot for me of sound design comes from growing up with This American Life, you know, the way they're telling narratives, but they're fading music in and out. I just grew up on that stuff. Like my early media sort of as an adult, my early media experiences were with stuff like This American Life and other NPR stuff like that. So I knew I wanted to fade the music to keep the vibes going and all that sort of stuff. Sarah and her fiance, now husband, helped a great deal with finding those artists. And the process of using those artists created something, I think, better than we could have possibly done with, you know, stock music or by paying for tracks online. It brought people together here, literally, at one point. I mean, we had a live show where artists displayed work that was inspired by Merritt and Karen, and musicians who had music in the podcast came to play live show for everyone. It did that community thing I'm interested in, that DIY sort of like built network, built community. I'm into that. And that was a big part of that for me, for the music.
And Sarah, it must be great to have the ability to bring some of these artists and put them on a platform that so many people get to hear too.
It's great music. I don't think people realize how many talented artists we have in Morgantown and Fairmont. I think we may have used at least one artist from Fairmont, but it's really incredible. Like the music, I'm really big into grunge and rock, and I can listen to other genres, but I enjoy that more as an experience if I'm listening to it live. So that's kind of what I'm drawn to. And we have just an amazing assortment in that area. You know, in the before times before COVID, that's what we used to do. And I thought it was great how everybody came together. They were really helpful. They wanted to help us with our project because they're struggling as artists themselves. And I thought it was really cool how we were all able to help out each other. And I really hope that people will check out their music and find some new artists that they love.
Well, I think only people from Morgantown will appreciate this. I lived at the Nyabingi Dance Hall when I was in college, so I know what a great music scene there is in Morgantown, and I think you've done a great job of showing off some of those artists. You know, we're at a time we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I really want to dive into Merritt and Karen, that podcast, and then, you know, for the next episode, we'll get into Big Savage, but the first one is the one that really put everything on the map for you guys, so we'll get into that in just a second. And And we're really going to focus the rest of this podcast on Merritt and Karen, the WVU co-ed murders. You've talked a little bit, Sarah, about how the story, you know, you found it and you really, you dove into it. You know, I hate to say this. I'm from West Virginia and I never heard of this until your podcast. Do you find a lot of people tell you that, or were, you know, when you guys did the podcast, were there, you know, it seems like a lot of people did remember, especially they're from Morgantown.
It's so weird, but it's exactly split down the middle. Like 50% of people are like, yeah, I remember that. That was awful. And then 50% are like, what? That happened here? Prove it. It's just, it's such a mixed bag. And I think that it has to do with whether or not you talk to people who are around in the 70s. I can't imagine you living in Morgantown in 1970 and not knowing about it. So I don't know if it's just that it hadn't gotten passed around. Like people move there. We have a college there. So maybe that has something to do with it. They missed that segment.
Well, and Kendall, you bring up something in the podcast that I will often tell people when they complain about today, you know, everything's so bad today. I'm like, man, you should have been around in the late 60s. There was a lot of violence and stuff going on back then. They were shooting people. And you bring that up. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that, because obviously you delved into that, you know, just how much more violent it seemed to be then.
Yeah, I started looking into that stuff because crime and politics was part of the stuff I was writing about. So I was relatively familiar with the way that, you know, violent crime sort of graphs look over time, over the years. I think people know, really, if they think about it, that it might have been worse. When we imagine what Times Square looked like in 1970 versus what Times Square looks like today, I think we kind of intuitively know, but for some reason, there's this lasting good old days mentality that just seems to persist each new generation. Like everything's getting worse when in fact, everything's usually getting better in almost every available metric. People don't like to hear that their fears aren't well-founded, but I think it's true in a lot of cases. Part of that back then had to do with the fact that when you had a serial killer case, you may have had the same person commit, you know, four or five different crimes in adjacent counties or, you know, counties that weren't that far apart from each other. And they may not have heard, you know, the counties may not have heard about it. They may not have connected with each other. There weren't these statewide info sharing, nationwide info sharing sort of stuff that we have in today's law enforcement. So it's this weird like combination of being able to identify, repeat, violent offenders, and also this weird kind of sentimentality that we're bound to have for the past, sort of viewing the past through these rose-tinted goggles, even when the things we're looking at are, you know, headless bodies in the woods.
I just wanted to add something to that because I wrote a lot about this. And what bothers me is that when you're looking at the statistics that Kendall's talking about, you're really only seeing a portion of what was actually reported. So you can just extrapolate from that what was actually going on, because not everybody went to the police over things, especially crimes against women. You know, it's just boys being boys. So the stuff that was reported was just a fraction of what was actually going on.
And I think one of the other underlying themes that you know, I've noticed is, you know, it's amazing that anything even got to trial or people got put away because the science was not very good back then. And you know, you run into that a lot, you know, especially with Merritt and Karen, just looking back at like the science then versus today, how much easier it might have been to find somebody than it was back then.
And I think a lot of that had to do with how much the officers are willing to put time in for, because it's a college town and they were patrolling and there were football games going on and you're getting pulled this way and that way. It really depended on the officer wanting to look into your case and putting the effort into it. And that's sort of a mixed bag.
Not only that, but the political atmosphere, I mean, at the time of at WVU and other places around the country was different. I mean, there were political protesters tear gassed in front of the student union, very close to around the time this case was happening. It was an entirely different environment. Although now you could say in some cities that sort of like those political protests have sort of reappeared and been added to the mix. But yeah, it's complicated.
Do you think also part of it being kind of small town in West Virginia goes, you know, kind of makes it harder as well for these crimes to be maybe processed in the same way that if two co-eds at NYU had their heads chopped off, I think it would have been a different manhunt than it was for them. Do you agree with that or not?
I think there was definitely an issue with how much the police were trained for that sort of thing. I mean, that's something that you're either prepared for or you're not. And I think the reason they were clumsy with it is because that had never happened before, and they had no idea how to handle it.
Yeah, that sort of case isn't the sort of thing you're prepared for as a police officer in 1970. I mean, it's not even their fault. The training just wasn't there. I mean, this was pre the word serial killer even really being around. This is a different time. So some slack is necessary to be granted here.
Just the one episode where you run down the list of deplorables, the folks that were all suspects in the case that then come back up in later episodes. So imagine having all of those folks running around at the same time is kind of scary.
There was even more going on that we didn't cover. And we kind of talk about that in the book, but you know, you can only put so much into a podcast. But there were like child abductions going on, and just kids were almost shoved into trucks. Luckily, no one was actually kidnapped, but I mean, it was just like a crazy time. No one was safe.
And I remember growing up in the 70s in West Virginia, where I would say every few months there would be a rumor that there were satanic cultists looking for little kids to put in their van and take them away and kill them. That story seemed to come up all the time when I was a kid in West Virginia.
Yeah, I don't know like if there's any validity to that. And I'm not sure, like, are you talking about maybe in the 80s, like during the satanic panic kind of era?
Probably, yeah. It was late 70s, early 80s when I was, I don't want to age myself too much, but yeah.
Well, I don't think that there was really any angle of a satanic ritual other than the way that the bodies were kind of hidden under the stones and rocks. And we had a police officer, I think it was Heiss, who claimed that there was something carved into one of the limbs in the shape of a triangle, and that the way that the bodies were positioned was a triangle. And so they sent the FBI some information to see if there was a satanic ritual regarding the way that they were, you know, laid out. And that never really panned out. And I don't even know what he was talking about when he mentioned the triangles, because that's not on any of the reports that was carved in there. And I just, it's crazy. I don't know that that was any kind of ritual at all, but that's the one that's persisted.
The whole subplot of triangle is fascinating. And I have to say, again, your choice of who, you know, how it was read, the letters, made me hate triangle even more, because the voiceover kind of gave that kind of know-it-all sound to it that really I felt the letters did. And what an awful thing to do is send those letters to the parents.
That really was arrogant and disrespectful. And I can't imagine you being so deluded that you're like, I have the answers and I deserve the reward money.
Yeah, I come from a very sort of religious background, and I guess it's not that unusual, but you know, I understand how people can believe weird things. Smart people can believe weird things. What's a little less easy to understand is how that you would think it was somehow a good idea to send this to the parents, like just emotionally for them, or like, you know, just propriety and that sort of thing. Like that's really more shocking to me than the, you know, the ability to believe that you participated in this thing. I mean, it's really, how are you so self-centered that you think it's a good idea to talk to the family of this murdered girl this way? So that was really my problem with it.
Right. It's like, hey, we know you're sad and all, but could you give us that money?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that as well. Are they still around? Have they done any public interviews? I'm sure you know, you've reached out to the family, but what can you tell us about them?
Well, Karen's parents are both deceased. Merritt's parents are both deceased. Merritt has some siblings that are still around. Her oldest sister's husband has made it really clear that the family doesn't want to talk about it anymore. So we pretty much just respected that wish, and we didn't reach out to them. I know that I've talked to some of Karen's relatives, and they're pretty supportive of the podcast, and they've offered like photos and letters and things that they have that used to be in her possession. So I feel like the family that she has left never really knew her that well, but they still, you know, they're very, we think what you're doing is right, and we think that she would want you to do it.
There were a couple of interviews from parents given to the press, and tell you what, when we air this, let's go ahead and put up some old photocopies of those articles. There's some photos of Bess Ferrell, Karen's mom, and she talks about the family a little bit and everything. So we'll put those up so people can read them to get a better sense of, you know, what the family was saying and thinking at the time. It seems like now they're done thinking about it.
I can tell you, though, that Bess was staying in contact with Eugene Clausen. She was writing him letters in prison, and she didn't think that he did it.
Okay, a couple things. Okay, first of all, I want to get to Clausen in a second, but just one more on just, you know, with Merritt and Karen, you know, the podcast bringing so much of the story back out and having people aware of these young ladies. And is there still talk of placing a memorial on the campus for them at WVU?
I've not heard that at all.
Yeah, not only is there not talk of a memorial on campus, we actually gave an interview to the alumni magazine for WVU. They came to us about it. We told them the story. We shared some of the images that we had the rights to share. We did an interview with them, and the story was nixed.
Oh, really?
You can imagine why, if you think about it. I mean, how many, let's say you're bringing your daughter to a campus, your 18-year-old daughter to a campus to attend, and there's a statue for the two girls that were beheaded when they caught a ride at campus. Like, you can imagine this isn't going to be great for PR. I imagine that they may have heard, I don't want to speculate about stuff, but...
I talked to someone who had worked on the article, and he was very disappointed because it was ready to go and it was pulled.
Wow. That's instead, they end up running like a crappy article about some guy named Maddie who runs a podcast company in Los Angeles. That's ridiculous. I'm offended.
I
should
am
taken
too.
Me off and put you guys on there. That's for sure.
I call for everyone to boycott Maddie.
Speaking of Clausen, there's just no way he did it, right? I mean, there's just, there's people that will debate back and forth, but to me, that just, I think you guys kind of tore that idea apart. What are your final thoughts? Or do you have, or you still have any, I mean, do you have any final thoughts on who actually killed them?
Kendall, you want to go first?
No. So I prefer not to speculate about who killed the co-eds. Some people find that weird. People are always asking me about it. I really view this as a sort of journalism, and I'm happy to point out where things contradict, obviously, and where things are inadequate, obviously, but I really prefer not to speculate about any of the podcasts that we make. In the process of this, part of telling that story was hearing Sarah and Jeff argue about who they think actually killed the co-eds, which turned out to be a good part, you know, for people to hear. So I'll let Sarah take that.
I want to say, though, that I kind of view this from an agnostic perspective. I wanted to argue with Jeff because I wanted to challenge him with his beliefs, but I can't really say that I feel that Crutchley 100% did it or Hacker 100% did it. I feel like there's just some pieces from this puzzle that we're missing that would make things so much more clear. It's been 50 years, and I don't know if I'll ever have like a really good feeling until I get some hard evidence, and I haven't seen it from anyone yet.
I have to say I'm hashtag team hacker personally, but that's kind of, it feels really weird to, to be like, oh yeah, I think it's this person versus somebody else when, you know, these are real people. And I think that's, and I think I can understand, Kendall, where you're coming from, where it is, you do have to at some point have a little, I guess, a little bit of that journalistic, not to make a decision.
Yeah, and I don't even really feel that it's journalistic integrity that's not making me choose. I just really, I want to see some hard evidence. I don't want to focus on one person so much that I'm ignoring evidence about something else. And I try to keep an open mind.
When you start looking at cases that have been wrongly decided or a person was wrongly incarcerated, it's a commonality you'll find that, you know, a small number, one or two investigators will become so set in looking at a certain person that they fail to even take in the information that might change their minds. You know, you just tend to look where you're already looking. It's just a part of human nature, I guess.
It's like a confirmation bias.
Well, and then like in the case with Clausen, it's also, well, this guy has to be in jail. Like he's already a terrible person. So let's just tease that a little bit, that it might in the back of the jurors' heads, which is, well, let's just get this guy off the streets, even though he was off the streets already.
Oh, he was a terrible person, no doubt. And he definitely deserved to be in prison. But I don't think that the right response is to incarcerate someone when you've got a maniac on the loose and you're just doing it to make people feel better about their environment.
I want to talk a little bit about if you've received the women's jewelry from the Crutchley's home. Did that ever happen?
Yes, we did receive the photos of the jewelry from Crutchley's home, apparently all from women that he abducted. We've put those on our Facebook page and we'll sort of repost them at the top, maybe pin them or reshare them so people can take a look. Unfortunately, we did not find Merritt or Karen's jewelry in that batch of photographs and presumably what they weren't in the house. So yet another dead end, but a very interesting one.
I think it's really important, though, that people take a look at that. There are still some bodies that were never identified that were victims of Crutchley's, and maybe someone might recognize a piece of jewelry as one of the victims that was never named.
And before we end this part, can you just tell everybody where to find the website, what the address, and then also the Facebook page so they can go check out those photos that you talked about?
Sure. You should check out Appalachian Mysteria on Facebook and also Chromatic Media. That's the personal company that Sarah and I made this podcast with before we joined up with Maddie and Jam Street. Either of those pages will be posting everything we talked about here on the Appalachian Mysteria and Chromatic Media Facebook pages. Our website is chromatic.media. That's chromatic.media.
We also have a separate site just for the Merritt and Karen podcast that we update. It is coedmurders.com. We have links to our social media. We also have all of the episodes available on there. So if anyone wants to check that out, it's coedmurders.com.
Well, thank both of you for this part one of our two-part deep dive with Kendall Perkinson and Sarah James McLaughlin from Appalachian Mysteria. Coming up in the next episode, we're going to talk about Big Savage. And we were also going to tease what's going to be coming up in 2021 with season 3 of Appalachian Mysteria. I'm Maddie Stout. Thanks for joining us. And we'll talk to you next week with part two.